You're listening to episode 347 of the Building Psychological Strength podcast. I'm your host, Dr. April Seifert. On this podcast, we uncover the information, tools, and techniques to turn our mind into our most valuable asset. Hello, friends, and welcome back to this episode of the Building Psych Strength podcast. I'm Dr. April, and I'm so glad that you're here. You know, it's interesting because in the last couple of years, mental health and mental well-being have really risen to be topics of interest, both, you know, personally among people and also professionally. We're having a broader discussion about what it means to support our mental well-being, and that is incredible. One of the things that still persists, though, is this idea of stigma, this notion that if somehow you are working on your mental health, whether it is preventive or whether you are addressing something that is actually concerning to you, that somehow something's wrong with you, or that you're weak, or that you have problems. And that's just simply not the case. Mental health and mental well-being are as critically important to us and the way that we experience life as our physical health and well-being. And we should have the same open mind and the same open heart to our own and others' mental well-being as we do to just people who decide they want to go to the gym. So today's episode is a really special one because we're really starting to address some of the stigma behind mental health and mental well-being and starting to bring out into the open these conversations that desperately need to be had. There's a reason why so many people are focused on mental health and mental well-being right now. It's because we've all been struggling for the last couple of years. The aspects of life and the protective factors that we know help keep people doing well just haven't been as easily at our disposal recently. And you can see it in how society is functioning and how we all are just feeling day to day. And so this discussion of how we can more openly seek help and more openly talk to others about our own experience, about their experience, and about mental health is critically important. This week, we are speaking to a woman named Sarah Schley. I actually met Sarah interviewing her for a summit that I helped the Heart Mind Institute with, you know, recently. They did their Global Resilience Summit and she took part in that. And I knew when I talked to her, I needed to have her on the podcast. Sarah is the author of the acclaimed memoir, Brainstorm, From Broken to Blessed on the Bipolar Spectrum. She's a business consultant, a speaker, and an author who's led organizational transformations at renowned companies around the world. She is also a mother, a grandmother, a community leader, and has been married to a great guy for 26 years. Here's the thing. She also has a bipolar 2 brain on the bipolar spectrum. We're going to talk about what that means. Sarah has kept this mostly a secret for 4 decades. 4 decades. She lived with this, all kept to herself. That is until now. She's choosing to tell her riveting story from broken to blessed to save lives, end stigma, and optimize healing for millions. Regardless of whether you think you might suffer from something on the bipolar spectrum or someone you know, mental health and mental well-being is a conversation that we need to have more openly, and I'm absolutely thrilled to be part of that conversation today with Sarah Schley. All right, hang out for one moment. We'll be right back. Sarah, I'm so excited to have you here for this episode of the podcast. We met recently recording for the Global Resilience Summit with Heart Mind Institute and that whole crew. And I knew when we had that conversation that we needed to talk again for the podcast. So thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much, April. I'm thrilled to have an opportunity to chat with you again.
You know, it's amazing. I almost want to start going, you know, from the current day backwards, because Can you maybe just describe your current situation to us today? Like what you're doing professionally and the level at which you're doing it today? Because I want to set the stage for people about the level of success you've achieved in what you're working on today, this mission, just vision that you have today, so that when we start to talk about your past, it really puts it into context.
Well, I have a consulting company that's dedicated to sustainability and worked for 3 decades with major corporations on environmental sustainability and social justice. So, you know, household names like Nike and Ford and British Petroleum and World Bank, but also smaller companies like Seventh Generation and most recently Eileen Fisher. And I've been really dedicated to sustainability from the inside out, integrating a systemic approach. And I've had the opportunity to work with, you know, amazing people in this field for, like I said, almost 30 years.
That's incredible. And I think it's incredible because you have been working at that level yet. One of the big stigmas around mental well-being and mental health is that almost if we admit that something might be going on or we seek help, that somehow that means we're not going to be capable or it's going to close off opportunities for us. So now I kind of want to go back and have you tell people your, just give us kind of the high level overview of your mental health journey, specifically back when you weren't talking about what was going on with you, and then kind of the discovery of what was actually happening to today, where you're so much more open and revealing this piece of you that you've kept hidden for so long.
Yeah. I mean, well, specifically to the risk you're talking about with coming out, so to speak, with your professional colleagues, I didn't tell people for 40 years. I mean, really only in the last 9 months did I fully tell all my professional colleagues. And even just a couple of nights ago, I gave a book talk and some of them were there and they're like, wow, we never knew this about you. So that gets into the whole conversation about the stigma, which I know we want to dig into, but to rewind the tape 40 years ago, I was a senior at Brown University. You know, it seemed like I had it all. I was playing varsity sports. I had fabulous friends. I had a 4.0 in science. I was going to one of the best medical schools in the country in the fall. And then it was like a flip switched in my brain. And all of a sudden it was like I'd been abducted by an alien. And then there's a whole story that comes after that. But it was like night and day for me, this experience. And 40 years ago, yeah.
That's incredible. And did you know, so this happened, did you suspect or have any idea what might be happening with you at the time?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't make a connection. I did. My mother and my grandfather both suffered greatly from mental challenges, which I would later come to find out, you know, what their diagnosis was and stuff. But I didn't make that connection because I'd been such a high performing kid. I mean, I was 21 and like I said, I had just been sort of sailing through. I had trauma from, you know, from my home that lots of folks have, but inside of my capacities and my functioning and my, you know, capabilities, I had no idea. And it was like you fell off a cliff and were tumbling head over heels with no way of stopping yourself.
I feel like we're going to dispel a lot of misconceptions today. One of them you just touched on, that, you know, so many times we are, you know, just moving through life and we see people who are so successful or who seem to have it all together. And we have this idea that like, mental health challenges don't apply to people like that, that somehow you should be able to look at someone on the outside, look at their performance and know, yep, that's somebody who's struggling. And if you don't see that, they aren't. And that's just not the case because you were doing amazingly well on the outside. And yet, yeah.
I was doing amazingly well on the outside and I would end up doing well on the outside again. You know, yeah. After a bipolar flare, after a severe episode, which would last months for me, right? So when I was, in an active bipolar depression moment, you'd probably be able to tell.
Yeah.
You know, affect, mood, lethargy, although I masked it really well. And so many of my friends, since I'd just come out with a memoir, friends of mine from those days in college were like saying, I had no idea. I'm so sorry. I wish I could have been there. I was good at masking it. Mm-hmm. But what was going on the inside was terrifying. Yeah.
What did it look like for you to seek treatment? I'm interested in this because when I think back, this is a slightly different analog, but I've lived with multiple sclerosis for 25 years, and I remember seeking treatment for it when I was a kid, and no one believed that that's what it was. They tested me for everything else, and it was this like 2-year process to really start to even narrow in and get close to what it ultimately ended up being. And those can be some really harrowing journeys. So I'm curious as to what it was like for you to go seek treatment and ultimately finally figure out what in the heck was going on.
Yeah, right. Well, April, it took me 25 years and five psychiatrists to finally get the diagnosis that saved my life. But a part of that I got to own because I wasn't going. You know, I mean, I had this image because of my mother and my teenage judgments of her,
yeah,
which later I didn't have, that I don't want to be like that. I'm not going to be the person that takes drugs. I'm not going to be the person. I'm going to tackle it with my, you know, persistence of sports and diet and exercise and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I went on a long and winding road before I was finally willing to seek actual psychiatric medical help. Yeah. I did go to see a therapist fairly soon into this journey because for some reason I didn't feel as much. I did have some stigma with that, but I remember I had some classmates who were like, oh, this guy's really cool and he's really going to help you. And I knew them and I trusted them and I didn't tell anybody except them. I still felt very secretive about it. So I did go to therapists along the way, but I wasn't willing to seek medication and psychiatric help for like 2 decades.
Mm. You just called out to another important factor that I want to make sure people know, this conversation that we're starting to have around mental health, especially because of the pandemic. The pandemic really took away a lot of the protective factors that we know help keep people more well, I guess.
Healthier,
weller,
yeah.
Better, yeah. more healthy mentally. It took away a lot of those protective factors. So we're having this broader conversation, but what you just mentioned, there were some people who you were close to, some friends who you were close to, who was like, oh yeah, this guy is great. It destigmatizes it to some extent.
Right.
And so anytime, you know, you as someone who maybe has gone and are comfortable with that can help someone else sort of usher in and feel a little bit more comfortable to go themselves. What a gift, because you're really just smoothing out something that can feel really difficult for someone when they're not used to going, when they haven't gone, and it's a new step for them. So I commend those friends of yours for letting you know that that's something that you can do without feeling stigma.
Yeah. Way back then. Yeah. Oh, sure. Now I like sell therapy left, right, and center.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think it's part of, there's a diamond approach that some of the bipolar docs that I've gotten close with use, which is, therapy, medication, support from your community, and then behavioral changes, the things that we can do, diet,
amazing,
exercise, et cetera. Yeah. So I'm all for that. Yeah.
Yeah. So you went to 5 different psychiatrists, long journey to try to figure it out. How did you ultimately determine, what the right diagnosis was? And can you just give us an overview of what bipolar 2 is? Because
I don't think
it's very well known.
No, definitely not known. So, you know, my experience of myself when I'm sick or when I have a bipolar flare, I call it, or depression, is severely what we would think of as depressed, you know, mm-hmm. lethargy, low affect, low self-esteem, not wanting to do anything, no pleasure in activities that I used to have fun with. Right. And so if someone like me walks into a doctor, be it a primary care physician, where most, therapeutic interventions begin. You probably know that, and that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
But whether it's your regular primary care doc or a psychiatrist, if I walk into that doctor, they see someone depressed. And most likely, I'm going to get an antidepressant, right? So I'm going to get one of those classic Prozac family, SSRI, right? Serotonin, what is it?
Selective serotonin
reuptake inhibitor, SSRI, but basically Prozac, those that you've heard of. And the problem in my case is that with a bipolar brain that I have, that drug can make me worse, much worse. All right. So it can actually make my symptoms worse. It can actually increase suicidality, increase anxiety, increase, what's it called when you can't sleep, insomnia. So those drugs made me worse and worse. And then when I go back, the doctor has the mental model, you know, the mindset that says, oh, she's depressed. She looks worse. Let's give her more of that drug.
Oh, wow.
Right. So it becomes a vicious cycle. And this has huge impact for, I'll give you a stat in a moment. But so how do you find out that this person is actually bipolar? Well, it was the fifth psychiatrist that I went to who was an expert on bipolarity and had decided to continue studying it. He's in his 70s then, right? And when I asked him, why did you get it right, number five, and the other four practically killed me? He said, because I knew my patients' lives were at risk. I have to keep learning.
Wow.
So he's a total hero. And so he gave me a bipolar spectrum diagnostic test, which took all of 15 minutes, 11 questions to properly diagnose what had eluded medical world for 25 years, that I'm actually bipolar.
That's incredible.
Right?
That had it's to have felt like, I mean, probably a mixture of emotions at that moment.
A whole mixture of emotions. And it was, I mean, so now if somebody tells me they, oh, my kid, just 2 days ago at this talk, somebody came up to me and she said, my daughter was just diagnosed with bipolar. And I'm kind of like, great. I don't mean to, you know, I don't mean to like diminish the pain and scare fear of that, but it's good to have a diagnosis because then you can treat it. So, because for me, and I have to keep saying for me, because it's not true for everybody, but in my case with my bipolar brain, the unipolar drugs practically kill me and the bipolar drugs are miraculous. They work. Here I am today talking to you. And, you know, knock wood. So getting the right diagnosis and the right medication is a life-saving miracle. And it only took 11 questions. But you had to have the doctor that had the mindset and the education that a bipolar spectrum exists. So now you're going to ask me, what's a bipolar spectrum, Sarah?
Exactly. Yes. Right? And where does bipolar 2 fit onto it? And how?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so, yeah.
I mean, I think in my book that we've talked about, which is called Brainstorm from Broken to Blessed on the Bipolar Spectrum, I very on purpose put the bipolar spectrum in the subtitle because I want people to say, what's that? You know, I've heard of a sexuality spectrum. I've heard of a autism spectrum. There's a bipolar spectrum.
Yeah.
Almost everybody that I've spoken to has not heard of it, even professionals. Right. So it turns out you won't be surprised, April, because you're a professional, that like so many other things in human existence, the bipolar brain exists on a spectrum. It's not black or white. It's not up or down. What we think of as bipolar with the huge mood swings, and the big highs and the big lows, and, you know, the that kind of classical people will say, oh, she's manic, you know, and they're talking about really one end of the spectrum, which is bipolar Roman numeral number one, which you would recognize easily and diagnose more easily because people get manic, right?
Yep.
That's the one end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
As you go down the spectrum, you don't have all the same symptoms. So in my case, I don't show mania. People like me with bipolar 2 and other bipolar spectrum manifestations of the brain. So there's other names. There's one's called bipolar, not otherwise specified, but there's just like a whole area of multicolors, right?
Yeah.
That we don't exhibit mania, so we get misdiagnosed.
Wow. I'm curious about these 11 questions. Was there something that stuck out? Now, you don't have to remember like a detail, like
I can
word
tell you
for,
what they were.
Word. Yeah. I'm curious as to like the few that you felt like when you were answering them, it resonated.
Yeah. Well, one thing I want you to know is in the public domain, because people are asking me, can I get that diagnostic question thing? Yeah. Well, I put it on my website, which we'll talk about after. It's on the website of Dr. Jim Phelps, psycheducation.org. You can find this. And it's simple and it's effective. So the questions for me were like, okay, so was your first incident before age 25? Yep. I was 21.
Yeah.
Do you have any family history of mood disorders? Well, yeah, my mother and my grandfather suffered horribly from this. you know, and then he goes, and did they ever put you on a SSRI and a Prozac? I said, yeah. And when they did it make you better or worse? Or did you start to feel better, but then much worse? Because sometimes it works in the beginning. And I go, yeah, absolutely. You know, it made me crazy. He goes, that's it. We know what you've got.
Wow.
I mean, it was that, well, there were 11 questions or a few others, right?
Sure.
But you had to have like 3 right to be bipolarity. And I had like 8 out of 10.
Right? So not like, to laugh at you, but it's like,
it's like this
whole journey to get here. And it's so clear all of a sudden.
We're laughing now, but really could have killed me.
Yeah.
I mean, and when you think about, I mean, I'm being, you know, it's not flippant, right? Cause like I could have left my kids without a mother, you know? Yeah. I mean, the world of hurt that is left behind by one suicide, right? Never, ever, that family never heals.
Right.
So I learned in doing research for the upcoming TED talk that, check this out, April, I could ask it to you as a quiz, but I'll just say it. Is the incidence of suicide higher or lower in bipolar versus regular depression, or same?
I mean, I would assume higher.
Bipolar people are twice as likely to take their own lives.
Wow.
As people, any kind of bipolar, anywhere on the spectrum. So I'm twice as likely, heaven forbid, to take my own life as someone with depression, but I'm misdiagnosed as depressed. So it's it's very literally lethal.
Yes.
If we don't get these diagnoses right.
Yeah.
And it's like a friend of mine calls it the depression imposter.
Wow.
Bipolar too. Because she works with postpartum women and a lot of them are actually bipolar, but get diagnosed as unipolar.
That was actually a direction I was going to go, because I think we talked about this a little bit on Global Resilience, and I've definitely talked about it on the podcast, but the fact that you went to 5 different psychiatrists is another point that I want to make very clear here. If you're going and you're not improving, you're not getting the outcome that you're looking for, go to someone else, go back, try again, because I've talked very openly on the podcast about my own postpartum journey. I had very severe postpartum anxiety. No one knew what postpartum anxiety was. And this was not that long ago. This was a handful of years ago, 6.5, 7 years ago. And at the time, you go in for your couple postpartum checkups, which is terrible if that's all we do, but you go in for your checkup and they give you this, it's basically a depression inventory. And I passed that thing with flying colors. I look like the most non-mentally having any issue. Like I look like I was doing great.
They missed it.
It wasn't until I'm like, I'm not okay. And I'm trained in this. And I had no idea what it was, but I knew I was not okay. And I kept looking and I stumbled across a postpartum anxiety scale. And it was like the tears started streaming down my face. I'm like, that is me. It's not that I don't. So in my case, the items that did it, it wasn't that I don't enjoy my everyday activities and the type of thing that would bump you up for depression in terms of like likelihood of having depression. It was that I felt like a caged animal. I was like, please let me leave. Can I leave? Can I get out of here? Like, I felt like I wanted to run and escape. And there were a bunch of other symptoms like that. But it took me going to my doctor for a second time and looking him in the eye and saying, I'm not depressed.
Okay.
I'm anxious. Like, this isn't depression, but I am not okay, before something happened. So that whole soliloquy is to say, keep going, because the mind is a very complex organ in a lot of ways. And it isn't a slam dunk to get the right answer immediately. Your case shows exactly that.
Exactly. And then, but one of the challenges, keep going, right? Is when you have a bipolar depression or another kind of depression, you don't have the energy to keep going.
Agreed.
I mean, I could barely pick up the phone. So I think this is where the allies come in, you know, whether it's sister, mm-hmm. brother, mother, father, kid, partner, friend.
Yeah.
Is like, if your friend or your beloved is not getting the results they need, you got to help, you know, persist, because they may not be able to do it. So what I did is like, you know, I would take the textbook from Dr. Phelps, the guy with the diagnostic test for bipolar, I'd say, guys, look up page 42, take this to your psychiatrist. If someone was calling me from, you know, Minnesota, that knew about my story. Or luckily my doctor is very open to input because it's an art, not a science. They don't know exactly how these various medications work. So, you know, yes, be persistent, keep at it, bring a book with page 42, show them, because so many of these guys and gals, you know, if they were trained before the most recent diagnostic statistical manual, the thing that doctors and therapists use to diagnose, if they were trained before the most recent one, which only came out a few years ago, and they stopped learning after medical school in 2005, they might not know. You're going to have to advocate. Yeah.
Yes. You brought up a great point of allies and people around us. What is your advice for them and how they can help? One, how to recognize when someone might need help. And then two, how to do it. Because so many times I find when people want to be that support person, that awkwardness creeps in. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. Is this my place? Is this? So I would love if you could talk a little bit about how we can be better support and advocates if it's someone that's close to us that might be struggling.
I would so love to. You know, it's like you teed up a ball for me to hit out of the park.
Yay, because good.
I got a 4-point plan. I've been working on this because what's happened as a result of the book, people are asking this question. They're saying, oh my God, I wish I knew how to help, or I couldn't recognize, or what do I do? And people want to help, but they don't know. And they tiptoe around mental challenges, right? Because they're scared to get it wrong.
Yeah.
So I say 4 things, because we can't remember more than 4, right? It's got to be 4. So the first one is, and this is assuming you're concerned about your friend, right? The first one is reach in, don't expect them to reach out. They won't. Okay. You got to make the phone calls. You have to show up. And I even have to remember that, even though I've been through all this, I got to remember that with my friend. I have a dear friend who's going through a pretty severe depression right now. A week will go by. I'm like, oh my God, I got to call Paul. It's like, I have to remember to reach in because he won't reach out. And then he's really happy that I did. So that's thing one. Thing two is listen without judgment, right? Just listen. So don't try to fix it. You can't, right?
That's so important because people will say,
you can't.
I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. You don't say or do anything. Just sit there and listen.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Because this Terry Cheney, this quote I love where she says, the disease feeds on silence. This disease feeds on shame. Shame feeds on silence. I will not be silent anymore. So this person is silent. This person is living on an island of despair. This person thinks that they suck, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, your self-esteem, you've got voices in your head that is telling your family's going to be better off without you. I mean, it's, you know, it's like that, right? So as an ally, or that I call it the emergency mental health team, because it's more proactive than ally. When you just show up with your loving awareness and your presence and your non-judgment and just listen, it's huge medicine, because a person's been on an island of isolation, despair, is now no longer alone. Just accompany them.
That is so helpful. That alone should take some of the pressure off of just taking that first step and reaching out, because to your point, you don't have to have the answers. You're not the person who's going to answer.
And it'll drive you crazy. Cause I had my mother, I know, I kept trying to fix it for her. I wasn't even able to fix it. She had a loop going around in her head with a mental health brain challenge. So anyway, that's 2. Point 3 is, okay, but you're like us and you want to do something. You're frustrated that you can't fix it. Right. But here's what you can do. Just do it. You take them to the doctors, you pick up the kids, you make dinner, you fill the freezer, all of these tasks, you do the laundry, all of these tasks are Herculean for your friend. And it's like, I think of it like cancer. If somebody had cancer, that people are showing up with meals, but they don't do that with mental health challenges because they don't see it. You don't see, I look fine, right? Why can't you make her own dinner for her kids? No, she can't. So you make dinner, right? My friend, a friend of mine filled my freezer. God bless her, right? When I had little kids. So there's very simple practical things. So some people might want to be the ones that just listen without judgment. And somebody else is like, I'm going to fill the freezer, Yeah. And so finally that I say, the fourth thing is, you're going to need a posse, right? This is too much for any one person to do alone. You can't do it by yourself. You're going to burn out. So get a team. And the beauty is that that community of love and action becomes just a beautiful thing for all of you going forward. Right. And then they'll be able to pay it forward. You'll be able to pay it forward later when you're feeling better, the person. So those are my four things.
That is so good. It's such actionable, practical advice, which I love. And your last point about you'll be able to pay it forward is such an important one, because sometimes, and I know this was the case for me when I was there in the darkest place of postpartum anxiety, like the further away I get from it, the more afraid I am for that woman,
because I see
more clearly just how deep it was. But in that dark place, I couldn't see ahead. I couldn't see anything other than the place I was at. So it's helpful to remind people that if you do experience that, there's an after. There's stuff to come after that and a chance to just reciprocate when, you know, a need arises for a friend of yours. And that's one of the things that I do today for, you know, friends who have kids and whatever. That's sort of my soapbox that I'm on, is this postpartum mental health. If you are on my Instagram feed and I find out you're pregnant toward the end of your pregnancy, you will get a DM from me that says, you probably won't need it, but if you do, you can literally cold call me. I am not going to question it. Here is a list of things you can say, and I'm not going to judge you. Go to Target, get this list and drop it off on my doorstep. Don't ring the doorbell. Happy to. Like any of these things and more are great to say, no judgment. And if we could do that for each other, it just would be such a different conversation and experience in the event that, you know, we experience a challenge ourselves.
Absolutely. And I mean, at that time, probably when you were going through it, you couldn't, like you said, you can't think past this moment, and it's not even going to register for you that someday, April, you'll be the person that says, DM me, cold call, I've never met you and I'm there for you. But it is who you'll end up being.
Yes.
You know, and that's a similar thing with depression, bipolar, pretty much drop anything. Yeah. You know, and now I wrote this book and it's become my life's passion about ending the stigma and saving lives and maximizing healing.
I want to talk a little bit about today, because you have really started being very open. You mentioned about 9 months ago. What was it like for you to start telling people? What was their response to it? And how did that feel after going through so many decades of being quiet about it?
Right. I mean, I had made a cognitive decision that I was, quote, coming out. And I use that in quotes with all respect to LGBTQIA plus community. And I feel like it's like that, because I was in a certain kind of, you know.
It's an important thing about you that you were hiding from
totally.
People.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So even though I'd made the cognitive decision that I was coming out, so to speak, and I had hired an Instagram company, you know, a social media company, because I'm old and I don't want to do it myself. And a neighbor up the street said to me, oh, I saw your post about bipolar. You know, I am too. Congratulations. Thank you for coming out. That night I was shaking.
Wow.
Like, I was in terror. Like, I'm like, oh my God, I did this. I'm, you know, I was like still terrified. But then I had to like talk myself down. Like, you're doing the right thing. You know, why is it so scary? Because the stigma is so massive. So, and my internalized stigma, internalized shame, internalized all that. But as time went on and I made the decision to go forward, I did a GoFundMe campaign to support the publication of the book. And I got so many beautiful letters and notes and calls. And if to this day, and now the book's out, I'm getting such beautiful feedback from people about, you know, again, like, thank you for your courage. Thank you for your vulnerability. Thank you. You know, and then me or my cousin, my sister, my brother, my nephew, my, you know, all these stories that they're now feeling comfortable sharing that they've never shared. Stories of death by suicide in their families, tragedies. So it's a privilege to be around that. But it's also what I'm noticing is like melting layers and layers of my own shame that I didn't even know was there.
Mm.
You know, that I feel like 50 pounds lighter. And
you've
I didn't know
carried
it
for so long. You just didn't even realize it was there.
Yeah, I didn't even know, you know, and now it's all out, you know. And when I did one of these like book talks on Zoom, and my kids are in the opening of the book, they're like 17 at that point, 20 now. And their godmother's on the private chatting me going, I'm not comfortable with these questions. You know, are you okay with these questions? Because they're very incisive personal. I'm like, are you kidding? I am out, baby. This is fine. This is what I'm doing.
Yes.
Like, bring it on. This is great. Because I got the kids' permission. I got my husband's permission. I got my siblings' permission. My parents were gone to the next world. So at this point, you know, I'm all in for telling the truth. And it's healing me. Talking to you is a blessing, right? Every time I have a conversation like this, I'm feeling lighter.
What you just described is such a beautiful example. So one of the things, we kind of mentioned this before we hit the record button. One of the things I like to do with this podcast is take something from psychology that is so conceptual, that like is in a textbook somewhere, that it seems like, what in the heck is that even? And make it so concrete, like so concrete. And this is a beautiful way or a beautiful time to do that. There's something in psychology called taking committed action. This means, so if you Google it, you can Google committed action. If you Google committed action, ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, you'll find the right definition for it. Committed action is when our mind is like sending us the ick. It's reminding us of the stigma. It's sending us the anxiety. It's, people are going to judge you. How dare you? Oh my gosh. Like, you can't do this. People are going to find out. You're going to lose your job. Oh my gosh. Like, the swirl starts happening, right? And we all know what that feels like. We've experienced it at some point in our lives, whether it's a situation like the one we're talking about or something else. Committed action is when you tap into what is deeper, the reason why you want to take the step that is causing your mind to go haywire. You're taking a step that your mind doesn't like. It's stepping outside of what's familiar. It's moving in a direction that we're not used to. And that churn that your mind is sending you is its way to get you to step back in line. It's trying to keep you from taking the action that is new for you.
Trying to keep you safe.
Yes. It's trying to keep you safe.
Keeping you safe.
Exactly. Yeah. But committed action says there is something deeper fueling me. There's a value. There's a purpose. There's a mission. There's a vision. There's a why that's deeper than what this swirl is. And I'm going to move forward in spite of it. I'm going to commit to taking the action that's in the direction I want to go, in spite of the fact that my mind is trying to keep me in the position that I'm in now. And I wanted to make that connection because it's such a beautiful example of that. So many times we can hear a story like you just told and forget to apply it to our own lives, that no, that conversation you're putting off having that you know would improve the situation, but your mind is squawking at you, telling you that it's not going to be okay. Same thing, committed action. Tap into the deeper reason why you want to have that conversation. Do it anyway. We need to do it anyway. And I just love the way that you described the process of telling people, because it's just a beautiful example of tapping into something that was important to you and moving forward anyway.
Amen. Wow. And you know, it could be generations, right? I mean, we need a whole other podcast on ancestral trauma and epigenetics.
Yes.
Right. So we won't go into that because that'll be two more hours. But I think that the ancestral trauma piece, you know, we inherit from our great parents, grandparents, great grandparents, whatever they went through. So if I'm going to, in some ways, what you're describing, I have to betray my mind. I have to say, mind, I'm
completely
not doing that.
Yes.
If I'm betraying the family story in some ways of secrecy, right? But then look how much healing it's doing.
Mm.
And I mean, luckily for me, before my mom passed, she said, go for it. She'd seen an early draft. So I feel like, you know, that's a good sacred thing. But yeah, it takes a lot to step out.
This is amazing. Sarah, this is just incredible. You have, I want you to tell people where they can find out more about you, and also the fact that you have a TEDx talk coming up that you're going to record in what, a week, you said?
May 8th. Yeah.
Exciting.
Very exciting. So, okay. So I did come out with this memoir called Brainstorm from Broken to Blessed on the Bipolar Spectrum. You can find it on Amazon. You can also go to my website, which is spelled the same as my name, Sarah Schley, SarahSchley.com. There's a lot of information there. I'd love you to sign up just for us to stay in touch. Blogs, et cetera, there. So those are the two places. And then, yeah, I'm giving a TED Talk on May 8th, which is from you and I are talking 8 days ahead of that. So I'm all geared up for the talk and I'm really excited. And my goal is for that thing to go viral.
So,
juice it up. Because I really do. I'm on this mission to end the stigma, save lives, and maximize healing. So let's do it, right?
Ah, Sarah, you're so incredible. I hope, you know, community listening to this, I hope you can understand why I knew we had to have this conversation here on the podcast. All of those links that Sarah mentioned, I will make sure we link up in the show notes description, in the episode description. So if you're on your mobile device, you can just swipe up and be able to get to all of those links. And then when your TED Talk comes out, please send me the link and then we'll update this description. So depending upon when you're listening to this, that TED Talk link might already be in the description. If not, check back and we'll make sure that we get this updated so that we can help push that out to a broader audience.
Fantastic. Thank you. Awesome.
This has been such a pleasure. It is such a breath of fresh air to speak so openly and honestly about something that, and now I'm talking just like any challenges, mental health and mental well-being wise, that will affect, dare I say, all of us at some point in our lives. And so I just applaud the fact that you are using your platform and using your energy to help bring just a more open conversation to this and help educate people. So Sarah, I'm a huge fan and I'm just so appreciative.
And I'm a big fan of yours, my friend. I guess we're in the same tribe.
I love it. I love it. Well, friends, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I have a few resources that are very important that I want to make sure that you have. So hang out for just a minute. We'll be back in just a second and I'll make sure that you've got links to all of those as well. Oh, I hope you really enjoyed that conversation with Sarah Schley. She was just so powerful on the Global Resilience Summit, and I'm so thrilled that we had a chance to feature her here on Building Psych Strength. Specifically, the conversation we had around stigma was so powerful. The conversation we had around how to support someone when they're going through a mental health challenge, it was so powerful. But also, having someone speak so knowledgeably and openly about something like bipolar is so valuable because it's one of those mental health challenges that we just don't, just in general, publicly, we don't understand very well, let alone medically and professionally, but just out in general life, it's very misunderstood. And as we move into the resources that I wanted to share with you, I want to highlight two episodes that are way back in the vault in the Building Psych Strength podcast. This might have been in the days before the podcast rebranded to Building Psych Strength. These are like vault episodes. But I'm bringing them back because each of them also touches on a topic that is very misunderstood. So the first episode that I want to highlight is episode 86. This was an episode I did with a woman named Mehdi Spies, and the episode is called You Are Here for a Reason. In that episode, we focused on suicidal ideation. This is something that is so misunderstood to folks, and Mehdi actually lost her brother. He died by suicide, and it became her life's work to speak openly about what it means to have suicidal thoughts and, I mean, really everything surrounding it. I love this episode because it really dispels a lot of myths about a person who might be having suicidal thoughts and opens up the conversation about a topic that is so critically important. So episode 86, it's linked below. You Are Here for a Reason with Mehdi Spies. I would really highly suggest you go give that episode a listen. The other episode that I want to highlight is episode 60. The actual title of it is Turning Your Struggles and Adversity into a Life of Purpose. This was with a woman named Shala Nicely. And Shala is someone who in her life has lived with obsessive compulsive disorder. This is another example of a condition, psychological and mental health condition, that we misunderstand a lot just in public life. People make sort of offhanded comments like, oh, that's just me being OCD, or there goes my OCD again, and whatever. And Shala does such a great job of non-judgmentally at all, but just clearly and articulately speaking about what it actually means to have obsessive compulsive disorder, her own experience with it. She's a psychologist also, so she has both the side of experiencing it herself and also becoming a practitioner. So it's just a powerful episode because it highlights how much we just don't know in general, in the general public, about some of these important conditions that affect so many people. So episode 86 with Mehdi Spies, episode 60 with Shala Nicely, two other mental health conditions that are very misunderstood that I would suggest you go listen to those episodes. The last couple of things I want to mention is that, again, I linked Sarah's website below in the episode description, sarahschley.com. Please go check her out. Follow her. She is just fantastic. And also a link to purchase Sarah's book on Amazon. It's just helpful to have a better understanding of the experience of people who are going through a condition like bipolar, just because we can recognize it and be more supportive. And heck, we might recognize it in ourselves. You never know. So I wanted to make sure we had all of those resources listed out below in case it's something that you want to go a little bit deeper on. Thank you so much for joining me this week. It was such a pleasure to have you here. It was such a pleasure to reconnect with Sarah. And hey, check back to this episode because depending upon when you're listening to it, I'm going to add another resource to that list. I'm going to add the link to Sarah's TEDx talk. Good luck, Sarah. You're going to be awesome. Enjoy yourself on that red dot. It's amazing. And finally, let's remember that time is the most non-renewable resource on the planet. And I'm grateful to each and every one of you who chose to spend some of your precious time with me today. I'm Dr. April Seifert, and I will see you next week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.